You're saying this because you don't have kids. You're saying that, like, I'm on prep all the time. This is my life, constant, 24/7. Like, what do you mean? I'm not like
different kind of pressure, because that's interrupt pressure, right? That's like you have to be alert and then intercept the situation and intervene in those circumstances. So I think that's almost like being a guard dog. You got to be like aware of things.
Yeah.
But to be productive in a focused way, the last time I can recall I had to do that was probably at the age of 18, when I was doing an exam. And you were sitting there, you had 4 hours to write an essay, and it was like you just had to punch it.
So you're saying we haven't been productive in like 30 years?
Absolutely.
Now okay, it's fair. Like,
let me take a look at my phone, you know, let me check the Instagram,
bad.
What's going on.
This is bad. It's not good for productivity. No, you're right.
Yeah. Everything's popping.
I don't know. No. I think there were the exams, but that's a long, long time ago. Pure period of productivity when you do like brainstorming session, when you're like looking at your product and feature, like when you're in the zone for like an hour and a half. But yeah, it's exhausting. It burns you out.
Yeah. I think we've lost the muscle memory for it. We now have to accept productivity and deep focus is basically 30 minutes, 60 minutes, that type of time frame. And the ability to really sink in and continue to power through, I think, is missing. I think artists, painters, people like that actually cultivate the ability to really defocus for a long period. Because when you're constructing a piece of work, sometimes you need to be totally in the zone. This is what my artist friend tells me, is that, you know, when she's painting, is that she has to just block out almost an entire day to be in there.
So, but you could say that, and then it's a question of efficiency and creating value and everything. That's a different question. But you could say, like, when I play Civilization, and you know, it's my video game, right? When I play Civilization and I do a session for 3-4 hours, when the kids are not here and I'm like at my personal time, I'm in the zone for 3-4
yeah,
hours.
Yeah, it's true. But it's also a turn-based game. So it's not focusing for 3 hours entirely.
There's a little
2 minutes, and it loops you back, and it dissatisfies you when you loop, so you have to keep going, and that's the addictiveness of it.
I think
it's actually it's amazing, but it's also
you're right, it's something else.
It's not focused. We're live, folks, so welcome to Founders Focus, episode 17. I can't believe we're at 17 of these episodes. When we started this series, I spoke to Steve Lucas at ISIMS, and it was never a plan to do a series on this idea, but suddenly it became a really useful thing to talk to recruitment technology entrepreneurs and founders and learn a little bit about, you know, themselves, like who is the person behind the product, you know, why are they building this thing, why have they seen a problem that they think that they can solve with a product? You know, what is the history of all of this? So I'm delighted to be chatting with my good friend, Nico Blia Silvestri of Platypus, CEO of Platypus. Nico, welcome to Founders Focus, man.
Thank you. Very excited. It was such, 17 already. I thought it was longer than this. But it was so cool to see the first few ones and then follow them on my... you know, obviously you should never be on Facebook during working hours, right? But not following it on my Facebook during working hours when you do it. And it's very cool. It is very, very cool. So I'm delighted to be invited.
What is interesting, and I think everyone can probably do a series of this type, but because we've narrowed it down to CEOs and to sort of people like have the pressure of being in charge of a business, I think this gives you a different type of complexion. So let me kick off with the first question, Nico. Like, what kind of thing, what CEO activities did you have to postpone in order to do Founders Focus today? I mean, there's obviously
lunch.
More... You're the second French guy that has mentioned food as the thing that they as the priority that they.
First of all, it is a priority and it's super important, I think. But I think beyond like, you know, like a priority or whatever, it's a time where I spend a lot of time with the people in the team, and you sit down and sometimes you socialize, sometimes you talk about business stuff, sometimes you have great ideas coming out of like just having an exchange and everything. So I didn't postpone lunch; I just did it before.
Yeah. I see what you mean, actually. Lunch is a good way to exchange ideas. I kind of, as you multitask, right? Because everyone is defocused. So they're focusing on, you know, accurately putting the fork into the mouth, you know, they're not doing this stuff. So you have to do some of that mental processing. And maybe the defocusing can help you then, you know, release some of the creative energy because you're no longer, you know, very restricted in that specific thing that you're doing. So breaking bread with somebody and just shooting the breeze might be a good component for creativity. I wonder whether
it really is.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's super critical. And I don't know if it's cultural or not, but yeah, you know that lunch break in France and probably in Latin countries is super, super important during the day. We take long lunch break.
Mm, absolutely. And maybe there's a good reason for that. I mean, it's
our food is better.
Yeah, can I remind the viewers that Nico is actually in Denmark? No disrespect to Danish food, but it's not necessarily an internationally renowned cuisine.
I've had a great discussion about this recently. It's not that it's bad. I mean, if you think about it, I think two of the top 10 restaurants in the world are here in Copenhagen. There's Noma and there is Geranium, the name of the other one, right? But I think is very much there's lack of diversity in terms of food in this country. In terms of
ethnic diversity?
No, I think in terms of like even dishes, like you have what's, I would, so like, I hope people don't send me emails saying, oh God, you, but I think there's maybe 5-6 great dish. That's it, right? And when I say great dish, that's either starter, main dish or dessert. I put everything in the same thing. Where like a country like France, Spain, Italy, or other countries, there's obviously way more diversity of food. There's more products as well. I'm not going to go into discussing the UK food because you know where I stand there, but...
I'm not going to get into this story. I'm by the way, I think a lot of it is obviously to do with climate and the availability of more produce, variety of produce. People in the northern Europe typically have a much sparser arrangement of food, and also very seasonal as well, historically seasonal, because in the winters, obviously there's like no fresh stuff, so you end up eating cured stuff and stuff that is preserved.
But it's good.
Yeah, I enjoyed my food. Last time I was in Denmark, I really enjoyed it. And I made a point of not eating any kind of food that was, you know, I try to eat as locally as I can whenever I'm there, simply because it's part of the experience to try stuff you would not buy, right? But I remember I was on a conference with this American guy, a friend of mine, Jim Stroud, you might know him. Jim just refused to eat anything that wasn't like American food. It was like
that
really
doesn't
quite...
exist. That term is non-existent. That's
I know, but it was like quite hard to find fries and a burger, basically.
In Copenhagen.
Well, I wanted to eat sort of Danish food, so I was let's go to this restaurant. It's a Danish restaurant. The Danish restaurant is not going to serve fries and burger. At least the one I was in, and it was like quite difficult to organize. It's like almost like hanging around with someone who has a very divergent food palette to yourself. It's like quite difficult because you have to make like a mega compromise, take turns in making a mega compromise because the one will not eat the other stuff. So yeah, it was fascinating. Anyway, good to know that lunch has been done already and you've had a chance to chat with the team and so on. Let's talk about sort of that creative process, product and product development. How does that operate within Platypus? How do you generate the new, how does work or product ideas get generated in the business?
So we're super flat as an organization in the way we function, right? So I think the first thing is that anyone feels that they can just come up with ideas from wherever in the business, being marketing, a new product, whatever. It's not siloed. But we started doing, now that we have a full-on platform, we have two products, we have platform and connect, right? Now we're really starting to be way more systematic. I think every 3 weeks in the same rhythm that we have sprints for our product and tech team, we sit down for like 2 hours and we do shit like this, you can see. Where we look at all the different features we got, the feedbacks, the usage of all the people that are on the platform, being like candidates or employees or users and so on, and what are they using, how often are they using it, what's the stickiness of it, what are the feedback, what do they like, they don't like, and everything, and then on top of obviously trying to come up with new features, because I don't think we started even scratching all the stuff we can do with the data we're generating in Platypus. It's very much like, how do we get the current features to be better for our users, more efficient? So what would they like more from what they already have to make their life easier? I think it's very much an ongoing process. The new ideas, the new feature. I think at the moment we simply have way more ideas than the potential of developing those ideas and features. So there's a big part actually that is a lot around prioritization.
Well, this leads me to the point, like one of the big challenges of any business is what you decide not to do. Because, you know, if you had like 26 hours in a day, you would do everything. But we don't. Every decision to do one thing is a decision not to do something else. Mm-hmm. So how do you as a CEO decide we're doing this? That means we can't do that.
It's very much linked to the strategic goal of the business for the next 6 to 12 months. So some stuff, some things are simply more important, even if they're not as exciting. I'm thinking, for example, integration with ATSs, which is something that we're doing more and more. And we have Tim Taylor and Greenhouse, and you know, like we started now talking with Workable and et cetera, et cetera. Is it the most exciting stuff to build? No. Is it something that turns you on when you think about new features and new ways of getting, you know, the data that we're producing to better use and everything? No. Is it better for our customers? Yes. Is it going to bring us more customers, more users that are like, oh, well, wow, now you integrate with Workable, then it's plug and play for me and Platypus? Yes. So there is a very hard business reality. What makes more sense financially? You know, what's going to bring the more value to us as an organization? I think that's step one. Step two, in terms of prioritization, is like, what is something that doesn't exist today and that people are going to get super excited about? What's going to bring new people to try this product because they've never seen something like this before? And this, I think it's more like the latest one we've released, Recruitment Insights, where we basically collect the data from all of your candidates and we can give you a cultural map of what type of candidates you attract to be able to work on your employee branding and maybe actually tailor your employee branding to attract different type of candidates that you didn't think you knew or you needed in your organization. So like, you know, business needs new exciting features that are going to bring people in. And then I think comes the fine tuning. There's something that's working that people are using, but we know that we can fine tune and make it better. That's the way we look at it in terms of priority.
Yeah, really, really interesting. It's good that you're very clear on it, Nico, because sometimes, you know, again, the startups that don't work are a little bit ones that are bandwagon-esque, you know, the latest thing comes out and they end up rushing features out or something just to, you know, cater for the latest thing that's interesting or people are talking about. And it's important to know what the mission is. Like, what are you trying to achieve as the product? And if you're confident that mission is still there, and for you guys, Platypus, it's all about hiring more effectively based on like how this person behaves, like getting more information about the candidates in terms of their behavior, and then seeing how they fit into a particular team setup. Sticking close to that, I think, is
I tell companies, right, I'm not here, I haven't built the tool that's going to tell you who to hire. That's always going to rely on you. This is your decision. What I've built is a tool that gives you data you didn't have before for you to better assess, do I want to take a cultural risk in hiring this person, or do I want to go for cultural eugenism and having somebody that's exactly like me? This is for you to decide. But before Platypus, you didn't have the data to limit that risk or not, to assess that risk or not. Now you
I love the terminology there, cultural risk. I've not heard anybody say that, but once you do say it, it becomes so obvious as part of the hiring decision. Like when you're hiring someone, folks, it's a cultural risk.
There is.
You don't know how that person is going to impact everyone else. He or she is not going to operate as a completely discrete unit, irrespective of their completely autonomously without interacting with other people in the team. So if that's the case, you have to factor in how is their impact to the other people in the team.
Exactly.
You need to find that information out. So cultural risk, what was the other thing you were talking about? Cultural...
eugenism. Like the term eugenism. Eugenism. Like let's have everyone the same way. The term that I really hate, culture match. I hate that term. Because it's basically like, it's basically saying like, I want you to fit in a box when we know culture is not a box. But culture match is a terrible term. But again, my job is not to tell you what you should or should not do. My job is to give you a tool, again, data you didn't have before. So now that you know where you are in terms of culture, and I'm not talking about corporate values, right? Those are two very different things. We've talked about this before. But now that you know where the team is, where the team lies in terms of culture, do you want somebody that's just plug and play? Very, very close to what they're going to experience in that specific team? Or do you actually want to create cultural diversity, cultural risk? You might want to take cultural diversity and therefore create cultural risk. But again, all this relies to where are you? If you don't know where you are, if you don't know what you don't know, then you don't know if you're taking a risk or not.
I love the idea of cultural risk because it gives the hiring manager or the person making the decision a clear presentation of the decision that's there to be made. I think the word diversity is important to use because it's probably an accurate description of what you're trying to do to get people, you know, different behaviors in your team. That's a different thought process in your team. That is obviously, to call out diversity is an accurate description, but it is a risk as well to do
it
that.
Is.
And sometimes it's worth the risk. I remember really well, a long time ago, I had this candidate. He was a CTO, but he was one of these CTO folks that was like clearly like a powder keg type figure. You know, you love or hate this guy, it's going to be this type, right? There's no middle way. And I remember speaking to the customer. I said, listen, man, you take this guy, what's going to happen is he's going to be like a depth charge in your team. And at least 30% of the existing team are probably going to resign if you do this. But he will shake it up. Like there's a reason why there's an empty CTO seat here, because the previous guy basically was not managing the performance of this huge group. And if you want to shake it up, this is your guy. If you want business as usual, absolutely, this is not your guy. And I remember very clearly that, okay, sometimes it is useful to hire someone who has a very different behavioral style, because you're dissatisfied with the current way in which your organization is operating. In other words, you want to change the culture. Therefore, you get someone who's very different in order
to do that. Exactly. And again, we're going back to the same thing. You cannot change something if you don't know where you stand. If you have an understanding of where you are as an organization culturally, how can you say we're changing the culture?
Let me ask you a philosophical question then, Nico. Do you think it is possible to change someone's behavior culturally, or is it better to change the person? Like what is the quickest way to achieve cultural change?
There's three ways. So it's not only me. It's paperwork, it's studies and everything. And we have a scientific advisor, Dr. Florence Vilsesch, who's the scientific advisor of Platypus. She's a PhD teacher at Copenhagen University. She teaches on inclusivity and company culture. So it's not Nico saying this shit. It's, you know, white papers and everything. There's three ways to change culture, right? There is internal communication, internal program. We're going to keep on talking about certain things and try to teach people, try to change people's behavior. It works, but it's super slow. It really is, because people will say, you will hear, yay, we need to change. We need to change as an organization. But when you start pointing fingers, but that means you need to change as a person. I don't need to change. I'm good the way I am. I don't need to change. So that's step one. It's a long game, but it will happen. Second way is to fire people. I mean, so
change
that's
people.
Change people. Drastic, very drastic, very efficient, very hard to control. In terms of what are the aftermaths, what's going to be the ripple effect of like letting these people go and everything, because you don't really know who's connected to who and who believes in the same thing and everything. So it works, but it's dangerous. The most efficient way, the fastest, the quickest, and the most controllable way is recruitment. You keep on hiring people that have certain values, that care for certain things, because your behavior is linked to what is important to you. And then you're going to bring your culture where you want it to go. Right. So if you've realized in our organization, we really want to make an effort on inclusivity and diversity. Step one, we're going to talk about it more internally. We're going to do training programs and teach people about bias, non-bias and everything, make them aware of the change. And we're going to keep on hiring people that very much care about inclusivity and diversity to accelerate that change within the organization. That's what works.
And you could let people go that have that you feel that, you know, I'm not that way inclined, or at least maybe hostile to those views.
You know what I always say, right? It's a bit not politically correct, but even assholes need a place to work.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do agree with this. And I think that ultimately there's going to be a business or a role for everybody in some way, which is why...
Or bad culture.
Know, yeah.
You not being in the right spot.
This exactly part of the reason why I'm a little bit more forgiving of cultures that are so-called toxic is because sometimes there's people with these behaviors that will otherwise be toxic people within a normal culture. They should kind of go to those cultures.
Agree with you. I agree with you 100%. Look, I mean, I made a post a few months back. They discovered a lava snail. There's a snail that lives on basically like lava stuff under the sea, right? And it's like the shell is made of iron.
Yeah,
exactly. It's amazing. Exactly. It's absolutely amazing. And you put anything else in this environment, they're going to die. Yeah. This is so toxic for them. But this person is super happy in that very, very toxic environment. It's literally the same with people. It is.
Yeah.
So some environment for me in my past, in the companies I've worked at, they were toxic. It's a heavy word, but they were not for me. I was not happy in that environment. But I had friends, people I'm literally still friends with today, that were thriving in this environment. And I'm like, so there's a place for everyone. It's just about finding that right spot.
Yeah. And this is where we need, I think, true acceptance of cultural diversity, which is accepting that certain bits of how groups behave are going to be quite, you would look at them and see that's quite awful. Like, you have to accept that you would have a problem with this culture, but true cultural diversity is to say, I'm going to accept it so long as it's within the realms of the law, and then allow people to go that way. Because hopefully the idea is if we can kind of allocate ourselves to the right kind of businesses and the right kind of cultures, more people will thrive and some of these issues will go away. What we don't want to do, I think, is just try and universalize the culture. You know, this is good culture, that's bad culture, and then try and force everyone this way. Guess what? There's a lot of businesses, a lot of people are not going to shine with that. Exactly. And they're going to end up feeling like super marginalized. This is not the way to go.
That's my issues with companies saying our culture is our corporate values, right? Or our mission statement. Because corporate values and mission statement, yes, they're important, but they're not culture. Just because you put beautiful words, but I mean, like what? Enron had integrity as one of their corporate values. Just because you put like words somewhere on your walls or on your website doesn't make it true. That doesn't mean corporate values or mission statement are not important. They very much are. They're super important, but they're more of an aspiration of what do we want to be as an organization? What do we believe is right as an organization? Culture is your people, and it's their behavior and what's going to experience.
Do you think it's possible to summarize a company culture in a phrase? Because I share your criticism of cultural values as a list of terms, right? Because everyone is going to say integrity, equality,
respect, yada, yada. And everything. Yeah,
everyone say, it's like in a CV, a candidate will always say they're a team player, inevitably. And it's like you probably don't even know what a team player is to put that in. What I think might be more compelling is if a company has thought about it and thinks we're going to describe the culture in a phrase again, because I think that forces it makes it more difficult for it to be a cliche. And it makes it a more kind of sticky as an orientating value, so, let's say.
Two reasons why I don't think it can be done, and there's some gray area around this. But first of all, I think the moment you write it, you're making it static, and culture is not static. That's my first thing. Culture moves. Your culture in your organization today is going to be different in 6 months. Because, I mean, if you look even at COVID, the impact it had on people, on what's important to them and their behavior and work and et cetera, culture in organizations today, 12 months ago, was completely different. Number one. Number two, I think it very much depends on the size of the organization. Can us today at Platypus, 26 people, do one sentence that's describing our culture? Yes, something close to anyway. And I have the data. Via our tool, we have the data. But if I look at companies that have been using Platypus that are like 500, 600, 10,000 people more, how can you're not going to describe one sentence? Well, then you're doing something global. And then again, I think you're trying to do eugenism.
Universalize.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not working. You could do it at department stage. A group of 30, 40 individuals with a subculture, then you could do it by saying like, this is how we function in that specific department. This is what's driving that specific department. Then it works.
You know, that's very, very interesting. Like, how many people does it, like how encompassing can a culture be before subcultures develop? Because, you know, there's some valid criticism to say, look, company culture doesn't exist because it's really team-based cultures, because this bunch of people sitting in this room back in the day, you know, in the metaphorical kind of space, they operate in this way. You are in this type of function. You operate in that way. Those are actually different cultures, even though you might like belong to an overall culture. But the real unit of analysis should be team rather than, you know, company.
Like even us internally, with 26 people and 25 of us in Copenhagen, one person in Buenos Aires, I already have four distinctive subcultures in my four departments, in tech, product, revenue, and operations. I already have four. There's an overall culture, things that are important at Platypus, that's flexibility, that is mission, that is impact out of the 12 core cultural drivers that, that we're tracking in our platform, right? But if I deep dive in my four different teams, and they're teams of 6 to 7 people, right? I see already cultural differences. I see things that are way more important for some team than for other ones. And if I didn't have that data, then I will try to manage and communicate everyone the same way. I will try to hire the same way in those departments, and I would not be efficient. Now, we're going back really to your efficiency discussion that you and I had at the start. Being efficient is what is tailoring and personalizing my management and my communication to the team that I'm working with, because I don't want to waste my communication by talking about the stuff they don't need to talk about or they don't want to talk about. I want to be able to focus on the right thing when I talk to them. Now I can with the data.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. I'm sure some anthropologists will be able to tell us, like, what is the optimal size of team or group? I think it's about 7 or 8 people, isn't it?
I think that's what I read. If you manage more than 8 people, then we're talking average here, right? But you cannot be as efficient as a leader with more than 8 people reporting under you.
Yeah. It's very interesting. There's probably some mathematics behind that, calculated based on the amount of time in the day, let's say, or stuff like this, where, you know, how much time you need to speak with people in this way. Fascinating that we've dived into this. Let's just keep going with it a little bit more, Nicole, because as a company that kind of started analyzing culture pre-COVID, and now we've had this incredible moment where there has been a huge cultural shift. What have you seen? Have you seen anything from how cultures have changed for the companies that have worked Platypus? Like, what has changed?
I mean, so we have the data, so I can actually show you. We should do a session one day where I show you. But out of the 12 core cultural drivers that we have in the platform, we have one of them called well-being. Well-being, it's important for me that the company is taking care of my physical and mental well-being. This is the one we've seen increasing the most over the last 12 months. Because, I mean, again, COVID, people have realized that, you know what, this needs to be more than a job. If I give 8 to 10 hours, if you're a startup or scale up, you work your ass off to an organization, I require certain things coming back my way. Compensation, compensation has increased a little bit, but not drastically. Flexibility and well-being are the things that are the most important to people today when we look abroad, like all the data set that we have in Platypus. And today we have data sets from 50 different countries. Companies that are using Platypus, they have employees in more than 50 countries. So we have data set across 50 countries, which is absolutely insane. And we see massive trends on well-being and flexibility.
Can you give us some stereotypes, man? Like, if you've had sort of the...
stereotype on San Fran compared to Copenhagen. Let's take two that are like... pretty, pretty far. Some stereotype that we had that we completely were completely wrong about. In Scandinavia, inclusivity and diversity is more important for men than it is for women.
Are you serious?
I am serious. I have data.
That's really interesting. How do you know this?
When we onboard an organization, employees are being asked to build a Platypus sprint, right? Like basically a cultural footprint of what is important to them between those 12 core cultural drivers. So they allocate point and so on. 10 minutes. We basically make you reflect on what is my perfect work environment today? What do I care for today? Because that's what I'm going to push for when it comes to my behavior, right? So we have a lot of employees in Scandinavia because we originated in Copenhagen. And we see this. We see the data in the sense of like, inclusivity and diversity is more important for men than it is for women in terms of employees. That doesn't mean that it's not important for women. I think that means very much that women today care for other things in Scandinavia. Is it because they feel that we've advanced enough on that side of the work compared to other countries? Is it because, again, like we see COVID has impacted and maybe this was like something that was super important to me, but after COVID, wow, I care more about flexibility and well-being. Like again, our logic is you cannot have everything. We're human beings, we want everything, but you simply cannot have everything. So today you're gonna have to do prioritization. Yes, there's a question?
No, hang on, well, before we go there, what I like about Platypus is that when you allocate points, like there's a finite number of points, isn't there? So you're forced to choose basically. So it's almost like a version of quadratic voting. If you know what quadratic voting is, it's like you're not making a single choice. You've got 100 points. You got to distribute them across these things.
We do 30 points. We have 30 points, 12 core cultural drivers, and we'll the beautiful feedback we get from user testing it, whether employees or candidates, is that you forced me to make decisions. because we all think we know what's important to us, but you've never sat across a room and we have to tell you, like, inclusivity or compensation? What is the most important thing for you today in a work environment? And the beauty of this tool is that it is 100% anonymous. So you can be truly genuine. There's no way your manager, there's no way the recruiter is going to look at your profile. So that's why I think we have super powerful data.
Do you know one thing as well that would make it even more powerful, man? I don't know whether you're ever going to build this, but you kind of make it clear to the person making the inputs that whatever they input, they will actually output also. So if they say that compensation is less important than this, should pay them less. because we need to remove social desirability bias, right? So if it's cost-free for people to say,
compensation is a super interesting one, Hung, because, like, again, we can slice and dice per gender, we can slice and dice per location, department, everything, but we can slice and dice the data per level in the organization. And the higher you go in the organization, again, we have the data, the less compensation becomes important. And that's because you've already hit a level of compensation where you're above the absolute minimum you need. You can actually save money. You can put money on the side because your salary is so... So right. We see compensation being very important when you're, like, early in your career or we're, like, you know, position that you know, it makes sense. I need to pay my rent and everything. So again, this data, you and me, when we talk about it, yeah, it makes sense when I say it like this. But without the data, you go from I think that's true to I know it's true.
Yeah, I get it. I tell you though, just go on this idea a little bit more. If you could configure your job based on these conditions, like let's say I do care more about flexibility, let's say, yeah, or I care more about, you know, mental well-being, then, you know, there's a quadratic voting system. I can't care about everything equally, but it may mean, okay, what I get as a result of this is like, I get like be able to nap 2 hours in the middle of the day.
But I mean, again, with the data we provide to organization, if that's how they want to use the tool, they can, because when we introduce you to a candidate that is, you know, aligned with your culture and value, you know the top three value of the candidate. If you know compensation is important, you can build something around the compensation. If you know if it's well-being, then you can build something around the well-being. I'm going back to what we've built. It's a data-driven decision-making process. I've built a knife. You can decide to stab people with it or you can decide to cut cheese with it. But you decide how and what you do with this data.
Yeah, and I like the fact that it is a step towards being sort of having a 100% configurable working style. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest problems we have in recruiting in the old way is that there is a set way this job is done. And if we're kind of jamming a human being into this set way of working, and it's like everyone needs to compromise, really difficult. It's not perfect. It's quite a horrible experience, actually. But now we're starting to push back on flexibility, which is great. Companies are coming back with, you know, fairly crude ways to be flexible, saying, you know what, yeah, working, you can change it, this, that, and the other. But your product is kind of helping, I think, nudge it forward to say, actually, yeah, you can totally configure the job, because I need to have less management. Let's say I hate management, or I hate the conversation style. I don't like to communicate, with human beings. Great. Mm-hmm. You can configure a job that does that. And it could still be a very effective and happy employee for your business. But without, you now know, how you can create the conditions for this person to do very well.
Exactly.
How very fascinating. Let's deal with this question, actually, that's come through from, is it Julia? So thank you so much, Julia. She said, okay, how do you see building distributed culture in a globally distributed team? And we talked initially about, do you want to force a universal culture, or do you kind of just lean with, you know, accept the regionality of it? But maybe you do need to have some sort of contiguity, right? You are working in a business together, at least in the same business. And, you know, maybe a better way of looking at this is if you had the globally distributed team in the same department. So maybe it's different if you have different departments because they have different subcultures anyway. But if you had, let's say, a bunch of recruiters, but they're distributed across the world, how would you deal with building a culture that everyone feels part of there?
So first of all, again, like, you don't build a culture, it's there. The moment you put five people in a team, there's a culture. The issue is then for you to understand that culture. We have one of the users of Platypus, whereby it's a fully remote team. Right, they are completely distributed, and that's why they wanted to onboard Platypus, because they were like, okay, finally a tool that's going to help us understand what is important to our people wherever they are in the world. Because otherwise, it's already difficult to understand what is the culture of your team when you're sitting here in Copenhagen without having personal bias of what you think you perceive in terms of people working together and asking questions and everything. So around like remote culture or like remote first culture, in my experience, the most important thing is communication. It really is communication. It's the fact that people feel that I don't need to be, just because I'm not sitting next to you, I can't communicate with you. So tools like Slack or Webby actually, tools that allow you to do this, like sit down and work alongside each other without being sitting next to each other. But what we see from the companies that either are fully remote using Platypus or from the departments that have a lot of remote employees in the specific department, we see again like a very, very specific trends in terms of what is important to a person when they work remote. Collaboration normally is super high, as in like, I know I'm working alone, but I don't want to be alone. I don't want to work alone. I'm working on my own, I'm at home, but that doesn't mean I don't want to be super collaborative. I think actually it's forcing you to be even more collaborative, to think of different way of collaborating with your colleagues. We usually see, again, well-being pretty high for the people that that work remote, because it's not because I'm not sitting in the office that the organization shouldn't be taking care of me.
You know what? I've just recalled now, like what you mentioned, Whereby, but I was like, Jess was actually part of this Twitter conversation I had with Ben, I forget his name, but a guy who basically founded Charlie HR. Yeah. I said the outrageous comment, actually, you know, you need less culture when it's like a remote only business. Everyone kicked off. And I kind of explained my case, I think, in his podcast. So listen to him when I talk about it. So maybe I was a bit of a provocative thing to say, but I totally get what you're saying. Just to address Julia's question a little bit, I would say one of the ways in which you could do it is you can ritualize certain things to help contiguity. In other words, make sort of some event or something that goes regularly that everyone is a part of that can be a building block to stitch people together in some way. That's what I've learned from recruiting Brain Food, for instance, is like the consistent email every Sunday, 7:30 a.m. It just comes out. It's relentlessly consistent. Are you okay?
I'm just opening the window. It's warm.
Oh, okay, that's fine. It looked like it was an urgent thing there. I wonder whether you're escaping a fire.
Nico!
It's like jumping out the window. Okay. We've really like gone into this tangent, which I really enjoy, but we need to talk about you a little bit, man. Because let's go back to your career history. You are an ex-recruiter, and I think one of the things that's super interesting in my experience is that, you know, recruiters who buy recruitment technology often say, "Oh, technology provider doesn't understand us. You know, we need more people from the industry becoming recruitment technology providers." And then it's like, there's like no recruiters that ever do this. So I wanted you to address this, Nico. Like, why do you think no recruiters actually tend to move into recruitment technology? And why are you the exception to that? Like, why did you make this change? So two questions. Why doesn't it happen as often as it does? And why?
I mean, it's true that it doesn't happen as often, but it's not only recruitment technology. I think it's HR technology. The number of HR tools that have been built or started by people that has never worked in HR is either super sad because that means HR is shit, or either that means HR is not supporting like the business wants to be supported. And on the recruitment side of things, so there's a lot of ATSs that have been founded by people that have not worked in recruitment. But is an ATS very much a recruitment tool? It's a CRM. It's taking somebody from a point A to a point B.
Yeah, but why do you think that is, though? Why do you think that is the case? Or maybe this is how software development is generally. Like, you don't see accountants turn into developers of accountancy software. I mean, is it a case that basically a domain knowledge, I guess, is not an advantage?
I think it is. I think the domain knowledge is an advantage. I think what we had with Dan, with my co-founder, we had an idea we wanted to build a tool that we would have liked to have on a day-to-day basis to work in recruitment, in culture. I mean, like, yeah, you said I have a background in recruitment, and then I went into the whole HR thing, like chief people officer in organizations. I've built HR and everything. So we wanted something that if you look today at culture in organizations, it's very much one segment only of you know, like the talent lifecycle. It's either engagement or it's employer branding, but it's not transversal across the organization. And our concept is that culture should be at the heart of everything you do with your people, because that's what makes you, it's the only thing that differentiates you from another organization, is who you are, is your culture, right? So at the same time, genuinely, I never, ever, ever wanted to be an entrepreneur. I never was. My dream was not like, oh, wow, I want to build a business. I want to become a CEO or whatever. Really not. I was happy like building Trustpilot, building Unity, building Falcon, Revolut, or Picon. I was happy building HR functions.
And these were when you were recruiting, right? You're a head of TA, head of CPO.
Yeah. But like generally, I was super fine with building HR and everything. But I don't know why recruiters don't. We're going to say something that has been heard so many times. Recruitment needs to change. I mean, every year you have somebody that says like, hey, recruitment needs to be rethought, rethink. But we're doing the same shit we've been doing for the past 25, 30, 40 years. It's people talking to people and then you get a job at the end.
That's the process, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that is what it is, right? So can it be retaught something completely different, something completely new? I don't think so. Like, I mean, how many times have we seen like, let's kill CVs. CVs are still there. And now it's like, okay, like people are telling me, oh, well, you know, I don't have a CV. Yeah, but you have a LinkedIn. It's your CV. LinkedIn is nothing but a glorified CV database.
Yeah, it's a superior CV. There's no doubt about that. It's in terms of the information that's there. It's exactly the same, and the architecture of the information is
also the same. You have the picture. You have the like title. You have your CV. It's a CV, right? The CV. It's not going to disappear.
Yeah, it's basically a GitHub for CVs when you think about it.
It is. So what are we doing? We've added stuff in that process, right? We've added stuff because in the past it was very much relationship based. Hey, I know that person that would be great for you and everything. Now we've made it like very, like global. I can hire somebody based in Buenos Aires. I don't know if they know me. I don't know if they know them. So we've made it more accessible in terms of talent, but that doesn't change the process. What we've done as well is put more stress tests around the recruitment process on is the person do good at doing their job? We've added personality tests. Now us with Platypus, we're adding what? We're trying to bring you data you didn't have before on the culture. But we're not changing the process in itself. So perhaps there's no more recruiters coming on trying to, come up with new recruitment tech. Perhaps it's because there's not that many things to change. We keep on saying we want to change recruitment process, but is it that bad?
That's actually a really good point. Like maybe there is already a full suite of stuff out there at the moment. As things change, you might get emergent pieces. Like I think Platypus might be an emergent an emerging category. You see things like interview intelligence software starting to emerge, which is I think a new category as well. I see compensation analysis type stuff that's starting to emerge. Again, some recruiters are doing this. So it's starting to happen, but it may need to have the gaps in the business be apparent. Like in other words, no recruiter out there complaining about ATS is motivated to build an ATS.
No, because again, like every time there's a new person coming to me saying, hey, we're building a new ATS. I'm like, okay, what's different? And there's nothing different. It is a CRM that takes you from point A to point B. Maybe there's an integration with LinkedIn. Maybe you do like video stuff and everything. Sure, but seriously, the main process is still the same. And it's always going to be the same because we need a place where we take people from point A to point B. So that's not where we're going to have like new things. What I like with what we've built on Platypus Connect is we believe there was a massive gap into how do people get to understand what they're going to experience culturally in an organization, right? And what do you do today? You're going to either go on Glassdoor, and pardon my French, but Glassdoor is an absolute pile of shit because I can't say this.
Dude, I mean, I need to go back and script that. Hey, listen, I'm not responsible for what this guy says. I mean, I just want to say that.
It's only my personal opinion. No, my problem with Glassdoor is you can't trust information because you and me right now can go on Glassdoor. Yes, I can go and write a review on Lego and destroy Lego. And I've never worked on Lego. And there's no way for Glassdoor to tell me if I worked on it. So I don't believe it's a good source of information. That's the thing. The second way you go on, you look at employee branding video. And that's exactly what it is. It's branding. It's basically how do I lie to as many people as possible so that they apply to my jobs. What I would feel with Connect is we wanted to solve this. We want that when I introduce you to a department, if you go on Platypus Connect, you build a Platypus Sprint, I know what's important to you, what you care for. When I introduce you to a department, I'm not lying to you saying this is a good culture. I'm not telling you like, oh, people are reviewing this department. I'm telling you this team, those 15, 20 people, 8 people that work in that department, they care for the same thing as you do.
Yeah, I tell you as well, man. I think what I like about you guys is that you're not making like moral judgments about.
No.
You know, you're not saying good or bad. Whereas Glassdoor is very much about good or bad.
It's the Roman Empire. You're living or you're dying. I mean,
it's usually it's a toxic environment. You know who I'm talking about, et cetera, et cetera. It's like literally a hit piece, and it might be true. But for a person reading that, it's like, oh, like, how do I know what's going on? I mean, maybe this person is a disaffected detractor, which sometimes when you leave a business, you're going to be obviously, you know, disaffected in some way.
Even the positive reviews, like I've seen it with my eyes, HR departments going down on the floor asking, hey, team, let's all go in the meeting room. Everyone is going to put review about the business because our Glassdoor thing is going down. So we need it to go up. And you're like, that's not genuine.
Yeah. It's basically brigaded. I think these days in the internet speak, that's called brigading, where you kind of
brigading.
I like that term. Yeah. You know what happens? Like I learned it on subreddit, where essentially there's competing Reddits, obviously, for political reasons or ethical reasons or whatever. And then what will happen is that you'll launch a raid on the other person's Reddit and upvote, downvote, and all this type of stuff. And it's basically similar to that.
Yeah. It is bad.
Okay, listen, let's talk about you, Nico. So when you became CEO, something you never thought you'd wanted to be, what do you think are the differences between being the CEO of a business compared to being like a leader of a department? Like you led departments, like what's the difference between leading a business?
You need to be at least average at so many things. Like you go from being super specialized. When I was chief people officer, I was super specialized on HR people, this kind of stuff. Now there's a lot under this umbrella, but it was only this. I was not looking into finance. I was not looking into operations. I was not looking into financing. And suddenly when you start a business, you realize, like, again, you don't know what you don't know, that you become, again, the T-shaped employee, right? You need to be super good at one thing. That's your area of expertise. But I need to become fairly fast, fairly good at so many things. Raising money actually being the most important one of those things, because you can have the best idea in the world. If people are not giving you cash to make it happen, then you basically just going to die. And the problem with this, I think, is that it leads to, it can lead to a massive inflating of your ego, because you then suddenly think that you're the best at everything because, you know, you've managed to make it that far or something like this. When actually, as fast as possible, you need to realize the one or two things that you're very, very good at, this is what you need to focus on. And what you need to do is bring people that are extremely good at what you're not good at or like not passionate about doing, because there's literally no point for me. As a CEO, my time is... it's the only thing that I can control in a way, but it is very, it's so important. What do I spend? Like with the question you asked me, like, what did I delete to take that call with you? That's the thing. During my day, there's things that I need to prioritize. Now, if I start prioritizing what I'm not good at and what's going to take a lot of time for my calendar because it needs to happen, am I being efficient? Am I being smart? Absolutely not. So it's as early as possible is finding the right people you're going to work with and bring in your organization to make you better. Again, it's really about making you better and making them better. So you need to learn so fast so many things.
Yeah, I totally get it. But what you're saying is the biggest thing is you identify the areas where you don't have any like intellectual commitment because you're not interested in it. And that means that you may be able to do it, but you'll be so slow and ineffective. It's actually a huge misallocation of important company resources for you to do this. And therefore, you need to get someone who does enjoy this, and you should offload that.
Budgeting. ASAP. I mean, budgeting, I can do it. It really doesn't turn me on. At home, it's my wife. She's the CFO of the Blier Silvestri family. She's taking care of everything. She likes, she enjoys doing all this stuff. I have my, you know, monthly allowance that I'm allowed to spend on my personal stuff and everything. And I'm completely fine with this. But for the company,
this is
certainly...
Japanese style relationship.
Is it?
Yeah. Apparently, it's a classic way where we talk about gender a great deal. Men obviously far out earn women in Japan. This is the stereotype. I think that stereotype is true. But what people don't realize is that women control the finances. So in other words, the guy hands the money over and she spends it. So she does the resource allocation, which again is not like moderated. So it's not as clean cut to say here's a massive. It is clean cut to say there's a pay gap, but we're not monitoring spend gap.
Yeah, exactly. That's super interesting.
Super interesting.
But we had to do the budget in the company. We had to start. So like the first few iteration, it was Dan and I, and I can, but I mean, should I? No, I'm not enjoying doing this, and I'm probably not the best at doing this. So
what do you enjoy? Like, what do you do as a CEO that you think, you know what, I enjoy this, this is good?
I enjoy sitting down and discussing the product and the features and how we push this further. I enjoy talking with our users on how they use the product, what they like and they don't like. I'm an evangelist, and I should be an evangelist. Now, that means for our users, for the people that want or will want to use Platypus, and it means with investments as well. I don't think I would say I enjoy doing investment discussions, but I think I'm good at it. Because we've raised a fair amount of money over the last 3 years, and we are currently fundraising, and we're raising more money. But I think it's related to the fact that I'm an evangelist. I love to tell the story of what we're doing.
I was going to say, let's lean into that a little bit more. Like one of the things we've seen, I mean, obviously, we've seen the situation in Ukraine, a terrible kind of scenario there. But one of the elements there that was that's very interesting is the visibility of the leader of Ukraine. And, you know, that I think has had a significant difference to changing people's perceptions and changing people's kind of even mobilizing people to do stuff. Now, I just wonder whether with modern media being the way it is, how significant do you think that sense of visibility is to a modern leader of a business? Because a lot of leaders like to be behind the scenes. They like to retreat behind the brand, and they like to operate at the back and stuff. I think that's a totally legitimate way to lead a business. But is it in future, as we go forward and it's more and more visible, like is the role basically of a CEO going to be more externally facing, ever increasingly so, than it was in the past, given the exposure and the media that we all have?
So I think the tendency is going that way. I agree with you. I think more and more you are expected to be represented, talking to VCs, talking to media, going online, writing stuff on LinkedIn and everything. I do still believe that it's very much dependent on what industry you're working in and everything. Some, like us, we're building something that's B2B, but that has a B2B to C aspect of it. And therefore, you very much need to be present. And I need to be an evangelization at scale and everything, right? But if I was in an industry that's not B2C or then I guess it's less needed. You still need to do the roadshow with the investors and everything. You still need to create some awareness. So I would agree with you that I think that's the tendency. The industry is going that way. You're going to need to be good at public speaking. You're going to need to be good at representing yourself, telling your story and why you versus another organization. But it's still very, very heavy in some industry versus others.
Yeah, I think it helps in sales, though, as well, right? Because basically companies, we still buy a lot from people, right? It's very hard to do due diligence on a product. We're kind of looking at basic stuff. Designers will tell you, oh, the colors would make a difference. Or, you know, it will be like who the person you're dealing with, your account manager or whoever it is, that can make a huge difference to whether you're going to convert there. So it's in some respects having the CEO or the leader of the business upfront and personal as we're doing here is a way to personalize what otherwise might be a brand that people don't quite have the ability to grasp. Is a brand is more abstract, whereas a human being is a human being. It's like we know human beings.
You buy from people you like. You buy, or it will be easier for you to buy from somebody you can relate with and build connection with. But at the same time, if you look at CEOs of big companies, they usually don't come from sales background. They come from operations, they come from finance, they come from product.
But they're all businesses now. So I wonder whether in future, like this is the kind of the idea I'm going with, is in future, maybe it shifts a little bit more to the outward facing folks. And you're going to get less accountant CEOs, basically, because operating the budget is super important. Of course it is. But presumably that will be supported more and more with technology. And you know, you can optimize that. You can imagine that the CFO role could is actually of the C-level roles, it may be the one that's most susceptible to automation, because what is the CFO doing? He's basically making decisions based on, you know, what is the best risk, what is the best investment. That is something you could probably program. Whereas this human aspect, this idea of leading as a person, is I think something it's going to lend more to people that are either greater sales, greater in, maybe in marketing or new marketing, if you like. Mm-hmm. Marketing actually is a surprisingly behind the scenes role in many cases in old school marketing. Yeah. You know, there's a new generation coming in, but a lot of marketers don't like to be in front of camera, don't like to talk about themselves in any way. So there's a new generation coming in. Okay. Let's keep going. In terms of your recruiting, sort of when you're hiring people for Platypus, of course you're using your tool to do this. Mm-hmm. But leaving aside the product itself, are there any like core characteristics that you would say this is the person? Is there any like heuristic, meaning like a rule of thumb that you would use when you're making a hiring decision?
For us at the moment is I want somebody that has been at that stage of an organization. We are 26, the 26 to 100 people, because that is so specific. In my experience, what I've seen at Trustpilot versus what I've seen at Unity or Revolut, for example, right? And I think too often, small organizations like us, 25, 26, they get wowed by the, oh, wow, it's an ex-Google, it's an ex-LinkedIn, it's an ex-Apple. They're going to be perfect for us. They know so much. They know so much in a certain situation, with a certain stage of organization. The game you're playing now is a completely different game. So for me, the heuristic is you need to have been at that stage.
I love it. I love it. We don't do this enough where we analyze the environment that the person's emerged from and what level of understanding they have. Like, for instance, if they have only worked in one of the big tech companies, as they do, sometimes people circulate between Google, they go to Amazon, they go to Facebook, and they've all worked in that thing. Are they going to be suitable for a 30-man business?
No.
It may not be the case. Yeah.
No, they won't. They won't be, because they want budget. They want tools that you can't afford. They're not. Let's build a house with like a pocket knife and a tree, right? They're like, no, I'm going to need a mason. I'm going to need a plumber and everything if I want to build a house that you want. I'm like, yeah, but no, that's not where we are. So
this is the old football joke, isn't it? When you refer to someone like Lionel Messi and they think, yeah, but can he do it on a rainy night in Stoke-on-Trent? And
probably not. Like,
probably not, actually.
No.
Probably not. Muddy field, lots of big guys prepared to kick you. Yeah, you probably wouldn't like that. Yeah. So yeah, you've got to basically get someone with a comparable level of experience of business maturation.
So we've hired them, like we're hiring, or we've hired, they haven't started yet, a CFO and a chief people officer, right, that are joining the organization. So first of all, some people are telling us like, wow, I mean, you're 26 people. Is it not too early to get a chief people officer? And I'm like, it's never too early to get a chief people officer. First of all, let's be very clear. And of course, due to the nature of what we're building as well, it makes sense for us to have somebody internally that's going to work both on the product side of things and work on the people aspect of what we're building as an organization. But these two, they're based here in Copenhagen. I've worked with them. I think that as well is a massive plus for me, because not having to build a relationship when you're so early in the business, when the trust is here already on how we work together, they know what to expect from me. I know what to expect from them. It is plug and play. We save 6 months. We literally save 6 months of time. And they've been at that stage of organization. So I just think it makes sense. Other than this, there's no... Like, we don't even, I mean, we want people that are different than us. I don't need an echo chamber. And if somebody was going to tell me, no, Nico, you're stupid. Good. Why? And then we move forward.
Yeah. And by the way, the idea of hiring people that you know in advance, I think, is underrated. And we probably don't talk about it too much because we're frightened of using like the terms like nepotism and, you know, stuff like this. We're frightened of it. But the key reason why this is something you need to lean on is because, as you say, there's already social capital built between those people. And it means that even though you don't need to get on with them perfectly well, but you can predict each other's behavior because you've had that experience before. And that is a removal of risk, because this person, you know how they're going to behave. I've got a very good friend of mine who I know is very, very talented, can do all amazing things. But if I knew how to work, I now know how to work with him. if I was to sort of work with him again, I would do so in certain conditions because I know how he behaves and he knows how I behave, so that, you know, we can kind of mitigate the any potential sort of fireworks that, you know, had happened prior to. So it's not just getting on with your mates. It's like understanding how people operate, that lessons that you would otherwise not be able to get without having, you know, gone through a period of time already working with. So you've almost like pre-banked the assessment, and you can, you know, bring that to bear. Okay, coming to the end of the show, Nico, let's have a quick, we haven't even talked too much about the product, but let's scan as to what's happening 2022. Like, what kind of exciting things can existing customers of Platypus expect? What kind of things are going to go on in terms of product development this year for you guys?
Yeah. First thing first is, again, to repeat, but we've done LinkedIn posts on this, but the product is free in 22. 100% free, full access to Platypus, full access to Platypus Connect. Moving to this free model, basically we went from 25 companies using Platypus in December to 75 as of this morning in 8 weeks, which is a pretty good number. So we're getting a lot of inbound. We're getting a lot of people that want to discover the product. And
what do you mean freemium? So what can they get for free?
Everything. What? It's free.
How do you make money, man?
I don't want to make money. This is not why I do this.
This is why you need to raise money. It's literally a money pit.
It is.
Throw money at this pit.
It is. But I mean, I'll ask you a question. How many years before LinkedIn or Uber were making money?
Well, they're still not making money. I think Uber's like constantly made a loss every year. But that's fair enough. Okay. Well, listen, if it's a free product right now, then it makes sense for people to just give it a blast. I mean, so essentially give us a quick rundown. What is Platypus? Who should use it and why?
Who should use this? It's basically sitting with HR, people in operation and recruitment, right? It is four tools in one. So with Platypus, you're going to be able to understand your culture better because we're basically going to ask every single employee to reflect on what's important to them, aggregating this data and giving you a cultural map of the organization that you can then slice and dice per location, department, gender, everything, right? So you become better at managing and communicating with your people. There is an engagement and survey aspect of it, because now that we know what's important to people, you can very much personalize what question to ask to whom, and you become more efficient in collecting the right data at scale from your organization. There is obviously a recruitment aspect of it. We ask your candidates to build a Platypus sprint, and then we give you the all very powerful alignment score, because you decide if you want to take a cultural risk or not with your candidates, but at least you know. You know where they stand, you know what to stand, and you increase your candidate experience because you know what to talk about with your candidates. You know, when you only have the CV and you're like, what am I going to talk about? Now you know we're going to talk about well-being, compensation, or inclusivity with that specific person because that's what they care about, right? And then finally, you have access to Platypus Connect. Platypus Connect, you need to imagine LinkedIn meets Tinder meets Instagram. Any person in the world that builds a Platypus sprint can be introduced to your organization if they're pre-aligned with the values of your department. So, with COVID, you don't know where your best candidate is. They probably never heard about you. They could be in Argentina. They could be in the Czech Republic. They could be in Hong Kong. But with Platypus Connect, they're going to be introduced to your department, and you can start engaging with talent that you didn't know you needed or you wanted.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. Exciting stuff. Listen, this has been a great conversation, Nico. Really enjoyed having a chat with you. I mean, obviously, we're friends, so we can keep talking forever. But we have to... For concern for your belly, I have to sort of finish the conversation. Actually, you've already eaten lunch, haven't you?
So that's my second lunch. I'm a hobbit. I do two breakfasts and two
lunches. Yeah, I need to eat a brownie myself right now. So we're going to close the show right here. Thank you so much for your time, Nico. Final word. Basically, if people want to check out Platypus, it's simply platypus.io, isn't it? Is that need to find it? www.platypus.io if you want to know about your culture and if you want to kind of hire people based on cultural alignment and occasionally take a cultural risk. So there we go. Okay, Nico, great to see you, man. We'll catch up soon, okay?
Yep. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Cool. What a great guy. I really love chatting to Nico. Hope you've enjoyed that show, folks. Follow the channel if you're interested in more founders' focuses. We've got like a load of them lined up. People are just desperate to tell their stories, and they are fascinating stories. So go ahead and go to Crowdcast, follow the channel. Or if you're on LinkedIn right now, click the bell button on my profile, and that basically keeps you notified whenever I go live. Okay, that's about it. I'll catch you later.